Bibles to Genesis 37. What we've been looking at is how to overcome sin within your own life. Genesis 37 begins one of my favorite stories in the Bible, and that's the story of Judah. Judah, as we're going to see, is probably one of the most messed up, depraved individuals you will ever meet. Yet, he ends up being the line of the Messiah, which is very remarkable, especially after you read the way he lived his life. Genesis 37, beginning in verse 19. Okay, you got Joseph is coming to see the rest of his brothers. Joseph is a special kid. The rest of the brothers hate him. So, as he comes, they say one to another, "Behold, this dreamer comes. Come now, let us kill him, cast him in some pit, and we will say some evil beast has devoured him, and we will see what will become of him." Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him in this pit, this in the wilderness, and lay no hand on him, that he might rid them out of their hands to deliver him to his father again." By the way, we're going through Genesis on Sunday nights. There is so much backstory here that we just skip over. Reuben has committed adultery with his stepmom and ticked off his dad. So Reuben really doesn't care about Joseph. He just wants to be the good brother again. There's really no way to tick off your dad any more than sleeping with your stepmom. So he's not really concerned for Joseph. He doesn't care about saving Joseph's life. What he cares about is getting in good with his dad. But here, all the brothers, they hate Joseph, they're going to kill him, and they're going to lie about his death. Reuben says not to. So when Joseph was come to his brothers, verse 23, they stripped Joseph out of his coat, and my Bible pages are stuck together, of many colors that was on him. They took him, they cast him into a pit, the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. They sat down to eat bread, lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead, with their camels bearing spices, balms, and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, notice Judah now. Judah enters on the scene and says this, "What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother in our flesh." And his brethren were content. Notice Judah's concern here. Judah's concern is if we kill him, there's no money in that. Okay, you can read this and go, "Oh, Judah's so concerned. He's trying to save his brother's life." No. Judah says, "If I kill him, I don't get any money for that." Now, I want you to look at Judah's heart here. Judah's heart towards his brother, he has zero problem killing the guy. But nobody's going to pay you to kill your brother. So let's just sell him. It's less messy, and we actually make money on the deal. So it's Judah's idea to sell their brother. So, there passed by Midianite merchant men. They drew and lifted Joseph out of the pit, sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he turned to his brothers and said, "The child is not, and whither shall I go?" Again, you look at Reuben. Reuben's upset because Joseph's gone. And what is his concern? How am I going to get in good with dad now? They don't care about Joseph. They don't care about him at all. So they took Joseph's coat, they killed a goat, they dipped the coat in the blood, and they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father, and they said, "This we found. Know now whether it be your son's coat or not." And he knew it and said, "It's my son's coat. An evil beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." Jacob rent his clothes, put sackcloth upon his loins, mourned for many days, and all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "I will go down to the grave to my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. I want you to take just a minute and let this sink in. Okay, I don't know if you've ever seen someone grieve. I'm talking like really, really, really grieve. It is extremely heart-wrenching, and you want to do anything you can to help them. If you've ever seen someone that you are very close to, like your father or your mother, grieve, okay, you really, really want to do something to help them. If you have ever seen a parent grieve for a child, you know that is one of the worst things you will ever see. And Judah was able to watch his dad go through the whole grieving process for his son and never once tell him he's alive. What does that tell you about Judah's heart? I mean, you'd have to have a heart of stone to watch your father grieve for his child for days on end. We're going to find years later, he's still grieving. And Judah knows he's alive and just sits there and tries to, quote unquote, comfort his dad. Dad, it's going to be all right. You're going to get through this. How hard does Judah's heart have to be? Well, if you want to know how hard his heart is, let's look at chapter 38. Genesis 38. It came to pass at this time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her, went unto her, and she conceived and bare a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bare a son, and she called his name Onan. And she again conceived and bare a son and called his name Shelah, which he was at Chezeb when she bare him. Right? Now, Judah now goes and marries a pagan woman. Judah, as you're going to see, is a pretty hard-hearted, doesn't care about anyone, does what he wants to person. He's going to sell his brother because you don't get any money to kill him. He's going to watch his dad just bawl his eyes out for years and never really do anything, never tell him the truth, any of that. And then he goes and sees some woman who's a pagan, and he marries her, and he has three sons with her. But he's such a horrible dad that his kids are vile human beings. Notice this, okay? Verse 7. Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. His first son was so evil, God killed him. Okay, not that, you know, he got incarcerated and, you know, was executed. No, like God himself looked down from heaven and said, you got to go. Well, keep reading. So Judah said to Onan, go to your brother's wife, marry her, and raise up seed to your brother. This something we'll talk a little bit later on in the morning message, a process called liberate marriage, which is raising up children for your brother. Onan knew the seed should not be his, and came into pass when he went to his brother's wife, he spilled him on the ground, lest he should give seed to his brother. The thing which he did displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also. Okay, Onan does not care about his brother and despises God's law. So he sins, and because he sins, God kills him too. Now, just take for a moment and let this sink in. Judah's still alive. One, that's a testimony to God's grace, that God hasn't struck Judah down. But looking at how vile Judah is, how vile must his kids be, that God hasn't killed Judah yet, but he'll kill his sons. Okay? This is a testimony to God's grace in Judah's life. Sometimes we take the grace of God for granted. Sometimes we just presume that because we haven't been struck dead by God yet, that we are living good, holy, pure, moral lives. I've heard people who have that mindset. Many people do. Well, you know, everything's going well with me. I got a lot of money. I'm happily married, got a nice house, got all these things. What do you mean that my soul's not right with God? Well, Judah was wealthy. Judah had all of those things. But it's very clear there's something very, very wrong here. Keep reading. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at your father's house till Shelah, my son, be grown. For he said, lest peradventure he die also, as his brothers did. Notice he doesn't even try to speak to his son about his sin. He's worried like, well, God might strike this one down dead too. So let's keep him away from the woman. Because apparently it's not his kid's fault. So she goes and she dwells at her father's house. In the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. Okay, so Judah's wife dies. Judah was comforted and went to the sheep shearers to Timnath, he and his friend Hira the Dulamite. It was told Tamar, saying, "Behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnath to shear his sheep." She put her widow's garments off from her, covered her with a veil, wrapped herself and set an open place, which is by the way to Timnath, for he saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him to wife. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a prostitute because she covered her face, and he turned to her by the way and said, "Go to, I pray you, let me come into you," for he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And he said, "I will send you a kid from the flock." And she said, "What will you give me a pledge till you send it?" He said, "What pledge will I give you?" She said, "Your signet and your bracelets and your staff that's in your hand." And he gave it to her and came into her, and she conceived by him. A lot of stuff there, but let's break it down. Judah's wife dies. And what is the first thing Judah does after his wife dies? Finds a prostitute. Let that sink in for a minute. Judah's character here is such that even when his wife dies, he doesn't really even grieve. "Yep, she's dead, let's go find another one." Judah's a very, very hard-hearted person. But if you look through the interaction here, it seems that Judah has a little bit of experience hiring prostitutes. I mean, it would appear that this is not the first time Judah has done this. So he meets this woman. I don't know about you, but for most normal people, this is not the way you begin a conversation with a woman you've never seen before. "Hey, how much money to sleep with you?" That's what he does when he sees some strange woman. That tells you a little bit about Judah's character. Right? So he goes, and they make this deal that it's going to be for a goat. He didn't have the goat with him, so he leaves some personal effects. A signet ring, bracelet, staff, things that would be very identifying of who he was. Now, for many people, when you think of things like prostitution, you don't want anybody to know who you are. Judah doesn't care if she knows who he is. And we're going to see he really, really doesn't care. I mean, this is kind of the idea of leaving your driver's license with the prostitute, is basically what he does. No, this is where you go by a different name, you know, you wear your hat down low, you go at night so nobody can see. This is broad daylight, him handing her his driver's license in the middle of the road saying, "Hey, how much money?" Okay, this guy doesn't care. He just doesn't care. So, she gets pregnant through this encounter. And so she arose, went away, laid her veil from her, and put on the garments of her widowhood. She goes back to her father's house and goes back to, "I'm a widow now." And Judah sends the goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite. Now again, notice how messed up Judah is. He calls, hey buddy. He calls his friend and says, "Yeah, I was with a prostitute last week. Can you go pay her for me?" Like this, again, how brazen do you have to be in your sin to where you really don't care if all your friends know you visit prostitutes? I mean, there is no secrecy in his sin. There is no concern. And he's sending his buddy to pay the prostitute. Okay? But he can't find her. His buddy goes and he can't find her. So he asks the men of that place, saying, "Where is the prostitute? It was openly by the wayside." They say, "There's no prostitute in this place." So then his friend goes around, "Hey, my friend Judah was with a prostitute last week. Anybody seen a prostitute? Anybody seen a prostitute?" So he's walking through the city going, "Hey, where's the prostitute? Where's..." Like, and this is Judah's best friend, by the way. What does this tell you about Judah's character? This man is a hard-hearted sinner who could care less about anything to do with God, anything to do with sin. He could absolutely, positively care less. So they say, "There is no prostitute." So he comes back to Judah and says, "I can't find her. Also, the men of the place said there was no prostitute in this place." Now, most people in this situation, if your friend came back and said, "I couldn't find the prostitute," and I started asking around, they'd be like, "You should do what? You don't tell people that we were looking for a prostitute?" Judah doesn't care. He could care less. Excuse me. Then Judah said, "Let her take it to her, lest we be shamed. Behold, I sent this kid and you haven't found her." He said, "Well, at least everybody will know I pay my debts. We tried. And the fact that you told everyone that you were there to pay the prostitute, that lets everybody know we're good to do business. Notice his concern. His concern is not that he's got a reputation of visiting prostitutes. No, he's worried that some people in that city may not want to do business with him because he doesn't pay the prostitute. And he, well, at least you made it clear to all the people of the city I pay my debts. Like, do you see what type of messed up person we're dealing with? Keep reading. It came to pass about 3 months after that it was told Judah, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot, and also, behold, she's with child by whoredom. Then he finds out, your daughter-in-law is pregnant. She's not married. Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burnt. Well then, if that's not a double standard, I don't know what is. Judah, your daughter-in-law is pregnant. She's been sexually immoral. Burn the prostitute. Now, as we look at this, you may say, well, what on earth does this have to do with us? Let's just be honest. With some of our habitual sins, we get pretty calloused too. We get pretty calloused. We begin to make excuses, and we begin to say, well, at least I pay my debts. At least I go to church. At least I don't cuss. At least I don't drink alcohol. And what we do is we let all of our sins that are habitually there, that we continually do, we begin to say, well, they're not as bad as the sin that somebody else does. They're not as bad as the sin that somebody else does. They're not as bad as the sin that somebody else does. And at least I don't do this. At least I don't do that. If you ever go and knock on the door to share the gospel with somebody, they'll say, well, I haven't killed anybody. And you know what? If you talk to a murderer in prison, he said, well, at least I'm not a drug dealer. We all have a sin we haven't committed, and that makes us moral and good in our own sight. And we have a tendency to be like Judah, to become very callous in our sin, to where we can do it, and we can do it, and we can do it. We can lie, and we can lie, we can lie. We can look at pornography, and look at pornography. We can get drunk. We can lose our temper. We can do whatever that sin may be. And we can continually do it, continually do it, continually do it. And if somebody was to confront us with it, we'd say, well, at least I'm not so-and-so, and at least I don't do what they do. As messed up as Judah is, if you are honest, we're just as messed up. But here is the one that just gets me. Is he believes all the people that do what he does should die. Right? Tamar's a prostitute. Execute her. But you were just trying to pay a prostitute publicly. But have you ever noticed that? It's easy to see in other people. It's very hard to see in yourself, but it's very easy to see in other people. Have you ever noticed how Republicans and Democrats, it doesn't matter, when their politician lies, it's okay. When the other politician lies, then, lying's horrible. We're all that way. We're all that way. We do this with our kids. Okay? You know, we'll lie to the person at the front door or lie to the salesman on the phone in front of our kids, and then we'll turn around and tell our kids, don't you ever lie to me. We do that. Okay? We have a tendency, and I don't know if you've ever seen many of the politicians, some of the others. I don't know if you saw, was it the guy in New York? There was a federal prosecutor in New York, I think it was, like this past week, that was trying to prosecute all the guys that were perverts, and then they found out that he was a pervert that had been abusing women. And he was out there just blasting all these guys who were destroying women, and then they found out that he had choked some woman. And you see, we have a tendency to condemn other people, even for the things that we do. This, by the way, is called pride. This is what Jesus speaks about when he talks about judging other people. We have a tendency to elevate ourselves, make excuses for our sins, and not allow anyone else any excuses for theirs. And we will even begin to condemn people for the very things that we do. We will condemn people for committing the sins that we commit. Well, they're just more brazen in their sin. Actually, Tamar is more secret in her sin than Judah was in his. Yet Judah has no problem bashing her. No problem. In fact, he thinks that she should be burned alive. Bring her to my house. I'll light the fire. Do you see the blindness that takes place? But if you look at your own soul, when you begin to have the attitude of Judah, what you are showing is that you are blind to your own sin. One of the things I've seen in my own life is that when I begin to condemn and look down on other people, is when I myself am falling into sin. So when somebody, whoever, gets caught red-handed on the news, and I go, oh, what an idiot, what a moron, that guy's so stupid, and I begin to look down on them, as opposed to saying, you know what? What he did was wrong, but it's only God's grace that's kept me from doing that. But when I begin to just go off on them, you know what I need to know about myself? That I am being arrogant. And I am not seeing myself for who I really am. In this moment, does Judah really acknowledge what was happening a couple weeks before when he's trying to pay a prostitute publicly? It's as almost what he did doesn't exist. And this is the main thing I want to address with Judah's life as it relates to us. One of the greatest ways to stay in sin is to not admit to yourself that you're sinning. And one of the first ways to overcome sin is to actually acknowledge that you've sinned. Now, the people at AA, this is one of the things they got right. One of the hardest things to get an alcoholic to admit is that they themselves are an alcoholic. If you've ever had a friend who's an alcoholic, and you try to convince them of it, that no... it's almost like, well, that was an out-of-body experience. That wasn't me. And that's one of the things where I think the AA gets it right, which is, you know, hi, my name is Daniel, and I am an alcoholic. Why do you do that? Because you have to identify, this is really me, and I'm really the one that does it, and I'm really the one with the problem. Does Judah have that mentality at this moment? No. And you and I look at that and say, that's insane. But you know what? Almost everyone in this room is doing that right now. Okay? Who wants to stand up and say, hi, my name's Bob, and I lost my temper and cussed out my kids this week? No. That's not who I am. I saw somebody this past week, somewhere on the news, or something, and that's what they were saying. That's just not who I am. And I'm going, but you did it. That is who you are. By definition, that's you. What you do is, by definition, your character. There's no other way to define it. Yet, you know what we do? We do the politician thing. We hate the politicians who do it, but we do it ourselves. These actions are not definitive of who I am and are not reflective of my character. Yes, they are. I mean, the fact that you did it means that's who you are. That's your character. But what we do is what Judah does. We blow it, we do something wrong, and then we go, only horrible people visit prostitutes. I mean, I wouldn't do that. Well, Judah, what do you think should happen to prostitutes? Well, you should burn them. What about guys who visit prostitutes? Burn them too. But Judah, weren't you... No, that was my friend. That was my friend out there. Well, why are you hanging out with somebody like that? Well, he was just paying somebody else's debts. Wasn't it yours? Well, you got to understand. My wife had just died. And I was. We do that. We do that. Now, read the rest of the story. Right? So, she's being brought forth to be burned alive. So they're bringing her to Judah. Judah's going to burn her alive. And she sends to her father-in-law. She says, okay, well, send this message to Judah before I'm burned alive. And said, by the man who these are, am I with child? She said, discern, I pray thee, whose these are, the signet ring, the bracelets, and the staff. So she takes basically the driver's license, and she says, okay, just want you to know, as I'm being burned alive, here's the guy that should be burned alive next to me. Here's the father of the child. And Judah, this is the whole key, acknowledge them. He acknowledged them. He actually acknowledged, yes, I am the father of the child. Yes, I visit a prostitute. If you want victory over your sin, I don't care what sin it is, how major it is, or how minor it is, you have to actually acknowledge that you do it. And I know that sounds very basic, but we run from that. We do. We run like the plague from actually acknowledging what we did. Have you ever asked a child to apologize? What do they do? I'm so sorry your face got in the hand of the got in the way of my hand. I'm so sorry. And I'm so sorry that I had to hit you because you took my toys. And I'm so sorry that it felt bad when I hit you. What will the child never do? Unequivocally say, what I did was wrong, full stop. Have you ever watched an adult apologize? I'm so sorry that your car happened to be there when I got mad at you because you cut me off in traffic. And I am so sorry that me rolling down the window and cussing you out made you feel bad. But you deserved it. And I'll be honest with you, you probably deserved a lot worse. And I'm sorry for what I did because you really deserved a lesson to be a lot more. And I really should have given you a lesson. So really, I'm sorry that I did more. We apologize. Watch a politician apologize. That's the way you apologize. That's the way I apologize. Well, I know what I said was really mean, honey. But the reason I said it was because you just got me so mad. That's the way we apologize. We never say, I did this. This was wrong. I am sorry. And that's the end of it. No, we have to make an excuse. We have to give a reason for it. We have to give a reason why what we said to our wife is not as bad as what our wife said to us. Right? That's what we do. And that you have to really understand what I was thinking and the way I was feeling in the moment. Because somehow that justifies our actions. That's the way we apologize. Notice that's not the way Judah accepts this. Could Judah make some excuses? My wife died, I was lonely, it was an emotional time. I was lonely because my kids. And no, Judah just says, yeah, I did that. If you want to overcome your sin, I don't care whether it's little or big, the very first thing you have to do is actually acknowledge that you do it. And I know that sounds way too easy, but I'll be honest with you, that is the hardest thing. The next time you have a child that you're trying to teach to apologize, try to get them to say three words and nothing more. Just try to get them to say, I was wrong, and not say anything else. You're going to have a hard time. Now, you try saying those three words and not giving an explanation. Try going to that individual and saying, I was wrong. And nothing more. I'm talking nothing more. You can't add to it. You mean just full, I was wrong. You'll have a hard time doing it, I guarantee you. Why? Because in our mind, we want to justify our behavior. And the moment we justify sin, it's acceptable. And the reason we continually lie is because we won't call it a lie. And what we'll say is, well, I'm sorry you misunderstood what I was saying. What I was trying to say was... See, doesn't that sound so much better? Doesn't it sound so much better to go up to somebody and say, you know, the other day I told you this, but really what I meant to say was the exact opposite? That's a whole lot easier than going up and saying, you know what, I lied to you the other day. But you got to say more than that, right? You can't just stop with "I lied to you the other day."
You got to go through. But you know, it had just been a long day, and I was tired. I wasn't thinking clearly. The reason you continually lie is because you won't look someone square in the eye and say, "I lied to you." The reason you continually struggle with the sin is because you make excuses. The reason young men struggle with pornography is because they will never say, "I intentionally looked at pornography." "No, I was on the computer. It was late at night. I clicked on the wrong link. And before you know it, that's where I was." That's not true. You're justifying it. You're making excuses for it. What you have to do is openly acknowledge your sin. We tend to do this with God. "Lord, please forgive me. I know I shouldn't have done that, but it's just been such a long day, and I was so tired." And there is a, if you look at Genesis 38, and then we're going to look at the rest of the book, there is a remarkable difference between Judah before this verse and after this verse. Like, Judah is an entirely different person after this verse. And this is why I want us to really focus on this. Because it began with he actually acknowledged it. There is no excuse. There is no justification. He just says, "Yes, I am the dad." Period. No explanation. "I did it." Keep reading. Okay? Next thing he says. "She has been more righteous than me." Whoa. She was the prostitute. I mean, come on. Like, if she didn't want to live that lifestyle, she didn't have to. She's the one that chose to go out the street corner. I mean, obviously, it's not his fault. I mean, just because you bought... I mean, she's the one that put it for sale. Just because he bought it doesn't mean... I mean, come on. But don't we tend to do this in all of our sins? We tend to look down on others. We tend to blame other people. "Well, the reason I lost my temper was because of how my kids were behaving." Well, you can't blame your kids for your temper. You can't blame your kids for your lying. You can't blame your kids for any of your sin. You can't blame your husband. You can't blame your wife. You can't blame your boss. You can't blame the car in front of you. You can't blame our society. You can't blame other people. But notice this. All of a sudden, the man who says, "Burn the prostitute," now says what? "The prostitute is more righteous than I am." What does that say about Judah's pride compared to right now? What character trait has Judah all of a sudden acknowledged? Humility, right? All of a sudden, Judah is now humble. All of a sudden, he went from, "She is a horrible prostitute," even though I visit prostitutes and don't care if anybody knows about it, to, "The prostitute is more righteous than I am." Have you ever paid attention to Jesus' story about the two men praying? Remember the publican and the Pharisee? And the Pharisee is praising God that he's not like everybody else. And the publican's just begging that God would be merciful to him. Who is the one that God hears their prayer? It's the humble man. It's the humble man. What you will find is that the man who brags about his righteousness is normally the person who's caught up in the most sin. And the man who talks about how sinful he is normally the man that's the most righteous. Because God exalts the humble and he resists the proud. God gives grace to the lowly and God brings down the proud. Humility is one of the greatest keys to overcoming sin. Now, in humility, that means you actually have to acknowledge that you did it. You cannot hide it. You have to be open about it. Because pride is, in many respects, I mean, it's what feeds our sin and keeps it alive. You can't let other people know you do that. You know what they would think about you? I don't know, maybe the truth? I mean, has that ever crossed your mind? I know there's been times in the past when I think about my sin and I go, "Oh man, what would people think about me if they knew that?" They would think the truth, because that's who I am and that's what I do. Why would I not want someone to know the truth about me? Because I have an overinflated view of myself. that who I want to portray myself to be is not who I really am. That's pride. Now, all of a sudden, Judah, I visited a prostitute, I paid her, I fathered the child out of wedlock, and then he begins to even go back further than just this incident with the prostitute. He says, because I did not give her Sheila my son, I didn't follow what God's law had commanded. By the way, Onan, why did Onan die? Because he despised God's law. You don't find Judah say anything about it till now, and all of a sudden Judah's realizing, I have despised God's law. I've gone against God's commandments. And this begins to move well beyond just, I visited a prostitute. All of a sudden you have a transformation where Judah begins to see all kinds of other sins in his life that have contributed to what we would call the major sin. What you will find is that the major besetting sin in your life is really just the fruit of a whole bunch of other things, like pride, a refusal to acknowledge what you've truly done and who you truly are, rejecting God's law in other parts and other aspects of your life. And what you'll find is I used to have this belief, and I think this belief, in some respects, held me in my sin. And that was, if I could get rid of this one sin, I'd be a perfect person. And then I began to realize that that one sin was connected to a million others. And that was just the manifestation of a million other sins. Because we have a tendency to do that. You know, if I could just stop drinking, I would be like the perfect dad. No, you wouldn't. You're just blind to all the rest of it. And now that Judah begins to humble himself and begins to acknowledge what happens, the blinders are off. And he begins to see more and more clearly who he is. Now Judah is a humble man. And we're going to see and look at the change that takes place. But don't you notice the very first change? He knew her again no more. His besetting sin here is gone forever. Now, is that not what you and I want? When we look at our lives and we see a besetting sin, a sin that continually comes up, continually comes up, continually comes up, continually comes up. Don't we want to live for the day where the sin is gone forever? Judah gets that. Why? Well, in some respects, because he was spectacularly publicly humiliated. I don't know that's what I want to overcome my sin. But in other respects, it's because he actually acknowledged his sin, all that led to it, and there was no excuses made. He acknowledged what he had done. He humbled himself, and he realized that prostitutes were better than him. By the way, who did Jesus say goes in the kingdom of heaven first? Prostitutes, tax collectors. Why? Why are those people most likely to receive God's grace? Because they have no righteousness to claim. The hardest thing to convince someone is that they're not a perfect person and that they cannot merit salvation on their own. And when someone is sufficiently broken to where they realize that there is no hope but God's grace, that's when God's grace moves in. If you want God's grace, then you need to realize as quickly as possible that you cannot do it on your own, that you cannot overcome your sin, you cannot get victory over your sin, that apart from God's grace, you are a worthless worm. It has no hope. You say, I don't want to be there. But when you're there, you'll be where Judah is. Free from your sin. When you're there, that's when you become the way Peter and Paul and the rest of the apostles became. When you're there, that's when all of a sudden you become so much more than what you were. That's how you overcome your sin. It's not through your own effort, but through God's grace. And God gives his grace to the lowest, the most broken, the most humbled. So there's a change that takes place in Judah here. I want you to see how remarkable this change is. So let's turn to chapter 42. Chapter 42 in verse 36. There is a great famine
And so Jacob has been sending his children down to Egypt. He won't send Benjamin because he's scared of losing Benjamin, because Benjamin's now his favorite son, and he's scared of losing him the way he lost Joseph. So he's been sending his sons down to Egypt to get grain. Obviously, Joseph's there, but Joseph's down there. He takes one of the brothers, and he binds up Simeon and keeps Simeon and sends them back and says, you can't come back for food unless you bring Benjamin. Now, let's begin in chapter 42, verse 36. Jacob, their father, said to them, me you have bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, Simeon's not, and you will take away Benjamin. All these things are against me. Reuben spoke to his father. Now remember Reuben. Reuben's the one who committed adultery with his stepmom. He said to his father, saying, kill my two sons if I bring them not to you. Deliver him to my hand, and I will bring him to you again. Wow, that's a pretty high stakes there. He says, Dad, if I don't bring Benjamin back, you can kill my kids. I don't know about you, but if I was like playing Russian roulette, my kids' lives wouldn't be on the line. If I was trying to prove someone how serious I was, I would not wager my kids' lives. Reuben is still trying to get back in his dad's good graces. And he says, Dad, I'm so serious, and I'm guaranteed Benjamin's going to be safe, so much so you could kill my sons if I don't. And notice Jacob's response. My son will not go down with you. Now, keep reading. Chapter 43, verse 1. The famine was sore in the land. It came to pass, when they'd eaten up the corn which they brought out of Egypt, their father said to them, go again, buy us a little food. Now Judah speaks. Judah spoke to him, saying, the man did solemnly protest against us, you will not see my face except your brother be with you. If you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down, for the man said to him, you will not see my face except your brother be with us. Israel said, why did you deal so ill with me as to tell the man that he had a brother? They said, the man asked us straitly of our state and our kindred, saying, is your father alive and you have another brother? And we told him according to the tenor of these words, could we certainly know that he would say, bring your brother down? Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me. We will arise and go, and that we may live and not die, both we and you and our little ones. I will be surety for him. Of my hand you will require him. And if I bring him not to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. Now, their father said to Israel, verse 11, if it must be so now, do this. Take the best fruits and land, your vessels, carry down the man a present, a little balm, a little honey, spices, myrrh, nuts, almonds, and take double money in your hand, the money that was brought again to the mouth of your sacks, carried again to your hand, prevent your oversight. Verse 13, take your brother. Now, if you were a betting man, and you were going to entrust your child to one of two men, and one man says, if I don't bring your child back, you can kill my kids. And the other says, if I don't bring him back, you can blame me. Which one do you think is more serious? The one says, you can kill my kids. Which one does Jacob trust? He trusts Judah. Why? Well, because Judah's the prostitute buying, sleeping around, advertising everywhere. He pays his debts to prostitutes. No, because Judah's a different man now. Notice, Judah also is not going to punish his kids if he doesn't perform. Judah's going to take the punishment himself. Okay? Notice, if Reuben fails, Reuben's not going to take the punishment. He's going to punish somebody else. Judah says, if I fail, you can blame me. And there is such a transformation in Judah, a radical transformation. He's now taking personal responsibility. Is Reuben taking personal responsibility for Benjamin? No. He's placing the responsibility on his kids' lives. Is Judah taking personal responsibility for Benjamin? Yes, it's on him. You see, all of a sudden, he's taking personal responsibility for his actions. And his dad has seen such a change in his son that you don't get much of a promise when, well, you can just blame me if your kid dies. That's basically what Judah says. You can blame me, Dad. If I don't come through, you can just blame me. And he says, you know what, that's good enough for me. What a change is taking place in Judah's life. Now, turn on to Genesis chapter 49. Genesis 49. Jacob, this is verse 8, is now blessing all of his sons. And he's passing on a blessing, and this is what he says. Judah. Remember Judah. The one who said, let's sell our brother because we can't get any money if we kill him. This is Judah. The one who said, hey, I pay my debts to prostitutes. Okay, this is Judah. You are he whom your brothers shall praise. He says, all of you young men, you need to look up to your brother. This is the type of man I want all of my children and grandchildren to be. Judah? What has happened to Judah? He's a changed man. Radically different. Keep reading. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Who is now the leader of the nation of Israel? It's Judah. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you are grown up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, as an old lion who will rouse him up. Okay, you hear the lion of Judah? This is where it comes from. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, okay? Nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. Shiloh meaning peace, the one who brings peace, the Messiah. And unto him, that is unto Shiloh, shall the gathering of the people be. Bind his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine and his teeth white with milk. That's a messianic prophecy. Essentially, what Jacob tells all of his sons is, I want you to be like Judah, because the ruler of the world, the Messiah, is going to come from Judah. What a transformation. Now, there's a couple of things I want us to look at and open up for discussion here on these. One, please don't ever lose hope. I have parents and grandparents all the time to say, well, you know, there's really no hope but God's grace now for my child. Well, one, there never was any hope but God's grace. Two, I don't think your child's out buying prostitutes and bragging about it. And if they are, guess what? They're pretty close to where Judah was. And you I know it hurts to see a loved one fall into sin. But do not give up hope. You will find very few people in the world as depraved as Judah was. Well, God can save them, but they'll never be any use to the kingdom. I've heard parents say that too. You know what? They've just completely failed. And they may make it into heaven, but they'll be of no use to the kingdom. What about Judah? The Messiah comes from him. You know what? They've just blown it. And I'm just going to, I have to tell all my kids and grandkids forever the example of, Uncle Ben, what not to be. At the end of the day, what did Jacob tell the rest of his family? I want you to be like Judah. You see, we have a tendency to watch the prodigal go astray and say there's no more hope. God cannot use them. Their life cannot be redeemed. They're too far gone in drugs and alcohol and sexual immorality. They're too caught up in this world. They're an atheist now. One, do not give up hope. If Judah can get this type of blessing, then so can your child, your grandchild, your friend. God in his grace can restore the most broken, faraway sinner imaginable. Right? That's the first thing. Secondly, I want you to see from Judah's life that there is hope for you for victory over your own besetting sins. If you will acknowledge them, if you will confess them, if you will repent of them, and if you will humble yourself. Okay? Any other questions or comments on this? Y'all see why it's one of my favorite stories?
It, to me, gives me hope for many people I know. It gives me tremendous hope. All right. Larry, you can close in prayer.